Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests. In this case, it's Ken Carlson, who made an incredible movie called The Heart of Nuba. If you don't know where Nuba is, it's the southern region of Sudan. Not southern Sudan, the southern region of Sudan. It's a country ruled by a vicious and indicted war criminal, Omar al-Bashir. And there's a couple of million people live in that area who, for whatever religious, ethnic reasons, are held in suspicion by the government, and they have minerals and oil under their land. And Ken, you went and made a documentary there. You've made a number of movies, features, documentaries. You made one that I think is incredible called Go Tigers.
Thank you.
Show it all the time to my students about high school football preceded Friday Night Lights. And as I understand it, you are making this movie, right, about Africa, about Sudan, and the Nuba people, because of your playing football at Brown University. So why don't we begin with that? Because it's really about a guy that you played football with who's now a pivotal figure in all this.
Well, that's true. Bob, it's a pleasure to be here. And yes, all things lead back to all things oblong. So it's all about football. You're right. That is a connection. I haven't really put that together with Go Tigers and The Heart of Nuba. But yes, this is a very personal story for me. This is a story about the only doctor in a region for about a million plus people. This is a resilient people, but a people that have been subject to great atrocities. There's a conflict there that's been going on for years, but it's pretty much a conflict that is a war that has been picked by Omar Hassan al-Bashir. So I met Tom Katina back at Brown University. We both are classmates and teammates. In fact, we were on the same defensive line. Tom is a nose guard. He was All-American. I was an outside linebacker. I was not. He was ferocious. He was a monster on the gridiron, and he's taken the same skill set, the same attributes, and applied it to what he's doing now in the Nuba Mountains. So he is providing not only medical care, but hope to a large region that is suffering under the hands of Omar Hassan al-Bashir, as you said, that vicious dictator, the genocidaire that's responsible for Darfur.
What we do in these podcasts, basically, I feature what I call American originals. A few of them are Canadians, some are more recent immigrants, but generally a notion that out of this crazy quilt of our culture, we get really special people. We get them for all sorts of reasons, but we have great diversity of ethnicity and religions and so forth. And Tom Katina, the reason I see him more as an American original. You are one yourself, a child of what, three generations of ministers.
Correct.
and from Ohio.
Amen.
And yet you've come to make these movies of great deal of social, I shouldn't say yet, you have come to make these movies of great deal of social content and meaning. But in this case, here was a guy from, please help me.
Upstate New York?
Upstate New York.
Amsterdam, New York, near Albany.
And it's in the movie. He goes home at one point for Christmas. He's from a Catholic family. And he was a guy who, in school, studied engineering, and then he decided he would become a doctor. And for 5 years, he went into the Navy because that was a more affordable way to become a doctor. He's obviously a very bright guy, very personable. But in the movie, you capture the sort of normalcy of Tom Katina. This was not a religious fanatic. This is not a guy who had, you know, extreme views of it. He was a kind of a, you know, a happy-go-lucky football player. And as with you, and you know, we get to a certain serious side of religion, he had a kind of calling here. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, he decided he wanted to study medicine. And then when he got his degree, instead of becoming a suburban doctor or making a lot of money or so forth, he chose to go work elsewhere where he was needed. So why don't you catch us up on who is this Tom Katina and that you played football with, and why did he take the path he took?
We explain that in the film, but it's really a pilgrimage for him, for all of us, I believe. Tom was, as I said, a monster on the gridiron, but he was but a sweetheart of a guy. I mean, literally, he would lay out a quarterback through a bull rush and then pick him up and dust him down and apologize for hitting him. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. When we all went out on Friday and Saturday nights, Tom would stay in and work studying, and he had Bible studies sometimes, but he was, as you said, not a pious guy that was reaching for martyrdom. He just simply was a decent human being, and you know, his humility on the football field. If you know anything about football, a nose guard is a position that fires out every play, and you never hear his name on the loudspeaker. The announcer never, pays homage to the line. His play is about a collision every single down, and not unlike that, he has applied those attributes to what he's doing in the Nuba Mountains, but with no glory. I mean, he does not want glory. He wants no attention. We always thought Tom would do something special, but we had no idea what was in order. And it's as I like to say, it's the closest I've ever come to meeting a saint on this earth. He does not in any way, shape, or form want attention for it. He just wants to do the work, and he wants to provide help to these people that are in great need of, and he truly lives his life with the mantra, every life holds the promise of hope. He truly believes that, and he could be making buku bucks here in the United States, living life of luxury and with all the creature comforts, but he chooses to be in a war zone in a very difficult, remote part of the world because he feels that is his calling. He feels that is his purpose. He had an epiphany when he was after he graduated from Brown, and he has stuck to that and has led him to the Nuba Mountains, and he lives a life of great sacrifice and great service to better these people. And I hope I capture that in the film. And like I said, he wants no attention for it, no spotlight. He just wants to do the work because he feels that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, he didn't even want your spotlight or the spotlight
not at all.
Of your film.
He fought me on that.
Yeah, and we should discuss that a little bit. But I mean, here, we should explain, there's a couple of million people here, and he's running the only hospital.
We don't know. The last time they did a census there was never. So we don't know if there's 500,000. We hear there's over 1 million. They think it's about 1.5 million, but it's hard to really calculate. But the bottom line is there's one hospital. It has 435 beds, and there's one surgeon. There's one physician, and that is Dr. Tom Katina. So we like to say he's the last line of defense. He's the only go-to there medically. So he is in harm's way. He's exposed. But he has a hell of a lot of work to do in an extremely remote and dangerous part of the world. I mean, there's 435 beds, and each bed has about two people. Pediatric ward has three. So when he does rounds each and every day, he's meeting somewhere between 700 and 800 people. Then he does a clinic after hours for about another 100, 150 people, as you see in the film. So this man is courageous, he's brave, he's selfless, but he's focused.
I want to take it down to the human level. Mm-hmm. There's a guy comes out of medical school, and it's interesting in the film because he clearly does not want the attention. And he's also clear that there's something odd about that this doctor in a Catholic hospital is a white guy, right, from upstate mm-hmm. New York. He ends up, I guess we can give it away at the end of the movie, he actually ends up marrying a local woman who is working at the hospital, a member of the Nuba tribe.
Yep, as a nurse there.
As a nurse. And his pitch, there's two points that really drew me to this film. One is, out of his religious conviction, his sense of human worth, every life has equal potential and meaning. So if he walks away and these people suffer, then he's saying their lives are worth less than, say, people in upstate New York, or Amsterdam, New York, or wherever. He was very clear about that in this film. He gets tired. He gets angry. They're being bombed. There's a lot of suffering. It takes him weeks to get home for Christmas if he wants to do that. He gets malaria. It's horrible. It's horrible to see what these bombs do to people. I mean, here we see war now is a video game and you shoot off these bombs. And when you watch Ken Carlson's documentary, Heart of Nubia, you know, there are scenes, you know, you remember, no, the arm comes off, the leg comes off. This kid, there's one kid in there, I can't get him out of my mind in your movie, but Dr. Catino makes the point. He says, look, his arm is gone, his leg is gone. This is an agricultural society. This kid, what is he going to do? Who's going to take care of him? You know, I mean, it's really heart-rending. And yet, you know, he's there and he doesn't have the white man's burden idea. He has just the opposite. If my work here has any worth, I have to help train the staff to take over my place. That's one very big theme, that in order for this thing to endure, I have to replace myself with local people. And there's a lot of that, the training of the people to run the hospital and the nurses. And the other is this very powerful idea, which we pay lip service to, that everybody's life matters. But he's really there. And he's got malaria. I've had a bout of malaria. You know, it's horrible. I had it in Cambodia, actually. And you know, the last thing you want to do is stick around. You want to get away and get treatment. And this guy really goes through a lot. And his house gets blown up, the whole thing, you know. And yet, what's driving it is not some abstract religious notion, but a very basic one. And he's not preachy. Just a very basic one. He said, look, if I walk away here, that means my life is more important than that kid's. And I don't believe that.
That's right. And that's, he is all in. He believes that 100%. It's not lip service. He's not acting. This is real. I mean, and Tom is an individual that will put others in front of himself, and to the point where he literally is wearing down. I mean, he's strong as ever, but we found out last year when he won the Aurora Prize in Yerevan, we insisted that he had a full physical done, and we found out he has two forms of tuberculosis. He has malaria. He just got pneumonia. He used to be 245 pounds on the gridiron. Now he's 140. We're talking about 100 pounds lighter because all he can eat there is rice, beans, and sorghum. So he is putting himself forward, you know, physically, mentally. He is all in. And the toll that it takes on an individual is outrageous. But your point is that it is about the hospital. It's about giving care, and it's about the Nuban people. And what Tom made me promise in order to make this film is it can't be about him. And I said, Tom, you've got to be my narrative through line. You have to be, you know, you are the reason I'm here, you know, and I will. He said, I need this to be about the Nuban people, the conflict and their plight. And I agreed with that. And so as I was discovering in the field, that theme came up, that he was literally preparing them to take over the hospital, ownership for them. And that's very powerful. It's not about him, it's about them. And he really lives that out to the nth degree each and every day. And when you see the film, I think that comes through. And I say this, though, with all sincerity, that it's hard to capture. When you see this film, you see the graphic nature of it, you see the work, but you really can't feel it because you don't understand how difficult it is, what he's doing in a war zone.
You largely shot this film. You had someone else working with you, but you basically, your crew that you had lined up originally bailed.
A crew of two.
You. Yeah, and you ended up doing a lot of photography yourself.
And sound,
at one point you had guns at your head, and a plane that had taken you to a spot wasn't going to take off and so forth. So there's a great deal of risk that you took in this. And I must say, and after the break, we'll get back to that. You actually went and met the dictator. We're going to have to talk about that, because what we're talking about is a group of people who there's a religious dispute. We'll discuss that in the Sudan. Not all the
resource
people,
curse,
right? That they have resources, and not only that, but they have different. You have some Muslim who are in this area, and then Christians and so forth. What's really fascinating about it is all this harm is inflicted by a dictator who's been in power for decades. And at a critical moment, and after the break, maybe we'll even begin with how you came to do this. You met with him after the first draft of the film was done quite recently. So let's take that break, and we'll be back. We're back with Ken Carlson, the director, producer, writer, it was really pretty much a one-man operation of a really brave film, The Heart of Nuba. And Nuba's area, the southern part of Sudan, not to be confused with southern Sudan, but Sudan, run by a really vicious dictator, Omar al-Bashir. And after shooting this film, editing it and so forth, Ken Carlson got an invitation, a strange invitation, to go actually meet the man who was inflicting. I mean, he right. sends the planes that drop the bombs on these people. And we should describe, the people are living in a very primitive agricultural situation. Their farm implements are quite primitive and so
forth. Mud huts.
But there's a great deal of joy and content, mm-hmm. meaning to their lives, which the film Heart of Nubia captures. So we come to really care a great deal about these people. And we see their interaction, which is incredibly loving and complex and, you know, in every respect. And as I say, the hero of this film, Dr. Tom Cotino, actually marries in to the village right. and is living there in the village as one of the people and is accepted. But the man inflicting all of this evil upon it, this vicious dictator, is still in power. And basically the human rights community, the world community, other states have kind of been indifferent to this. So why don't you give us the larger picture and how you came. It's not in the film. I think it should be in the film, but we could discuss that. But sure. you actually came to spend time face to face with this dictator after he had seen the film.
Yeah. How often does a filmmaker get to face the antagonist, the villain of his or her film? Very rarely. And I was able to do that. One of my neighbors, Don Burris, introduced me to this woman, Janet McGilligott, who said, I know the president of Sudan, al-Bashir, and I'd love to introduce you to the majority leader, Mahdi Ibrahim.
Wait a minute. One of your neighbors in
Santa Monica knew a woman that professed to know Bashir. Worked as a liaison between the Catholic Church and the Khartoum government 20-some years ago. And I took the meeting, and lo and behold, she said, I'd love to see the film. If I think it's the right thing to do, I will introduce you to this Mahdi Ibrahim, the majority leader. And she saw it. She said, I would love to introduce you. I think it's a powerful film, and I think that we could actually help broker peace over there if we got into the right hands, and that would be ultimately al-Bashir. So this man, Mahdi Ibrahim, flew out from Washington, D.C. I met with him for lunch and sussed him out, vetted him, and I thought he would be worthy of showing the film, because you never know with the Khartoum government, you know, what you're getting involved with. So I showed him the film in my home, and at the end, he fell to his knees and he wept, and he flat out said, I am shocked and I'm ashamed. I said, come on, you had to have known you're bombing the Nuba Mountains.
And he's a part of the government.
He's a part of the government. He's the majority leader. I mean, he literally has the power. He's the Paul Ryan of Khartoum. So he literally said, I will make this my mission to stop the bombing, to get it to Bashir and to stop the bombing. I said, great, thank you. Didn't think that would happen, of course, because keep in mind, this is this genocidal regime. Sure enough, within 2 weeks, I get a call from Mahdi Ibrahim saying, I'm proud to say that the president has seen the film. He reacted in a similar way as I did, and he has given us this quote, the primary reason for the ceasefire that he has declared is the Heart of Nuba. You can only imagine how thrilled I was, but yet I thought, is this really going to happen? I reached out to Dr. Tom Cotino in the war zone, in the Nuba Mountains, and he, in fact, said the bombing has stopped. So that's how it happened, but keep in mind, this is a ceasefire. It's temporary. It's not a peace agreement. We know that at any moment it could erupt again, because this is a man wanted by the International Criminal Court. You know, he's most wanted for 10 counts of war crimes. He said, he reached out and said, I would like to tell my side of the story. And I said, well, what does that entail? That means you need to come over here and I'm allowing you to interview me. So, of course, I asked my wife, Katrina, is that okay? And she looked at me like, are you crazy? But she said, this is part of the story. You can go. I thought about my children. Is this the right thing to do? I enlisted Nicholas Kristof. I also had to send a letter in, same with Nicholas Kristof, who was going to accompany me. we had to admit wrongdoing by entering the country, for me, twice illegally. And I put that in letter form, sent it to the New York Times. Nicholas Kristof looked at it, gave it to legal. He changed a few things. We sent our letters in together, and they granted permission. Nicholas pulled out 5 days beforehand because he was on his way to North Korea to interview Kim Jong-un, which unfortunately didn't happen. So I went on my own. And he, Bashir, wanted to prove to me that his side of the story needed to be told.
But here you've got this dictator that has been in power forever, and he's killing these people. You've made a documentary basically calling him a war criminal, and your doctor, Tom Katina, says, where is the international court? Where is criminal, you know, where is justice against this criminal? Mm-hmm. No question. You don't pull any punches in this documentary. And that's the documentary this dictator looks at, where you're calling him a war criminal, and then you decide that you can risk your life, because that's what you're doing, to go over there and interview him. And so you must be scared out of your mind, right?
I've learned in my life to compartmentalize. That's what I did when I shot this film in a war zone. I was able to take the fear or the reality out and do my job. But this was actually more of a facing evil type of situation for me. So yeah, when I went in, I thought, it's just the stupidest thing I've ever done. I've just admitted my guilt of entering his country illegally. I hear all the time that he detains people. They torture. So probably not the wisest decision that I've ever made, but it did bear quite a bit of fruit, and I'm glad that I'm thrilled that I did it. It was a surreal experience to be there, interviewing, like I said, the villain, the antagonist of my film. But you know, keep in mind that at any moment this could have gone sideways. But the umbrella that I operated underneath was sanctions were being held over their heads. Obama had lifted temporarily sanctions in January of 2017. And I was there in September, and the decision was going to be made by the Trump administration by October 12th if the sanctions were going to be lifted permanently. So I knew that an international incident, especially one involving the United States, a filmmaker such as myself, would run that amok quickly. So I went there thinking that I had that at least my back, but that's not going to stop a genocidal maniac like that. But it did. And I was able to get out with the story.
So you're a filmmaker, and you got concerned about what's happening in this area. You make your film, but now you're also taking the next step. You care.
Absolutely.
And you want to do something about it. So you work with human rights groups, which hadn't done quite what they should have been doing. So you become, you kind of organize around this film.
That's right. Yeah. You know, we were not blessed to get into some of the large, the better known film festivals. I mean, I'm an alum of these film festivals. I was crushed when it didn't happen. But I knew after 5 months of fighting to get into, you know, these well-known festivals that I needed to mobilize. I needed to get to create a human rights coalition. And I did that with Bonnie Abunza, who is an activist that is well-connected. And she helped me put together over 70 NGOs, entities in this coalition. And that has been the proverbial wind beneath my wings that propelled me into the interview with Bashir, and I checked in with them, conference call two times, and said, is this the way we should do it? Is this how I go about this? Is this the right thing to do? Are we stepping into the right? Are they going to consider this propaganda? Are they going to take advantage of this? And they all had their opinions, but ultimately we decided that this was a rare opportunity and we took advantage of it, and it has bared some fruit.
Yeah, there is a ceasefire interview, and it's held what now for a few months?
It's 14 months. 14 months.
So,
but it, like I said, it's temporary.
I got it. It can change.
You understand that.
But. I got it. That's why people should watch the film. Because, first of all, it's not only could be continued in this area, but it's typical of a lot of the mayhem in this world. People are being bombed in areas we don't know about by vicious dictators that we don't know enough about. And you've actually made it a very human story. But most human of all, take me moment by moment. You get on a plane, and you're going to go. I noticed, because I mean, I've been in some.
You've lived this.
Well,
I've
been in different countries. I was actually in North Korea at one point. I've been in lots of different places. But I know, I mean, I'll admit to being frightened out of my mind under different circumstances. I'm trying to see it. You get a plane in L.A. or something, and then...
That wasn't that difficult. I mean, I was able to fly into Khartoum. I had to fly through Dubai, but right. You know, that's not that hard.
No,
but
and then you get there, and what, you're met, and you're taken to...
I'm met by... this Mahdi Ibrahim, and I had to give up my passport, which was a frightening thing because we all know that is that's your currency in a foreign country. And I was taken to a hotel, and I thought, okay, this is exposure. What's going to happen? And by the way, the trip to the hotel, we went through some abandoned warehouse district, and I thought, okay, here. They're not messing around. I mean, the first thing they're going to do is take me into some warehouse, some empty space, and they're going to interrogate me, or they're going to press their opinions on me. So I, you know, that was the first thing I had to get over. But it led up to, you know, I was there on a Friday night.
You put it mildly. They could have tortured you and then killed you.
That's right. And they have a tendency, a proclivity of doing so.
Yeah.
I knew that was all a part of a reality, and I knew that I was, you know, I had a wife to answer to and to three kids, and it was so. Yeah, it was frightening. You know, I'll readily admit it. And the day of, we were met by his henchmen at the gate of his palace, and these guys looked, you know, like thugs. And I thought, are we going to get in? And when I get in, is this where I'm going to remain? I mean, you just don't know. But fortunately,
so it's you and a camera, right?
I had one other individual that was with me as a cameraman. Then I had a sound team when I got there. There were about 40 of his handlers there. And we filmed a little, filmed some trophies and some, you know, some things on some shelves, and they stopped us down quickly. And it was a very serious, you know, thing. And they sat us in these throne-like chairs. His throne was, of course, a little taller than mine. But they allowed me. I mean, I interviewed him for an hour and 15 minutes, and I asked some pressing questions. To his credit, it faced me. And after seeing this film, he knew I was highly critical of him. I don't want to give any credit to that man, but the thought that he allowed it to happen, he wanted to tell his side of the story, and he thought that he could affect the film. So when we went to release it theatrically, when it got out there, his side of the story would be told. Well, the truth of his side of the story is a big lie.
I saw the film at that stage.
That's right.
I know exactly what that film looked like. It was a devastating indictment of this dictator. No holds barred. I mean, this flat out, this guy ought to be in jail.
It's reality, Bob.
Yes, but no, but that's what your film really had, and Dr. Tom Cotino, this guy's a war criminal. This guy should be held accountable. He's killed innocent people, you know, and so the film cuts him no slack at all. It doesn't say, well, maybe he had his reasons, or maybe it's a civil war, or the fog of war. No.
It tells the truth.
It said, these people have a primitive agricultural existence, and this guy sends jet planes over to bomb them, destroy them, kill them, and then we have this doctor trying to patch up their bodies when an arm and a leg have been blown off, and the poor five-year-old is going to, how's he going to live? So this is the guy that your film describes all of that without, you know, holding back.
This is a genocidaire. This is a man responsible for Darfur.
So, and then you are ushered in there, and he's seen your film.
Yeah.
And so what are the first words? I mean, what do you...
The first question was, you're the commander-in-chief. You know, understand what's happening militarily in this country. And in other words, yes. And he said, yes. I said, so then you know that the Mother Mercy Hospital was bombed in May of 2014. And he went, no. I mean, just, I knew at that point that we're in for, as Hitler says, you know, the colossal lie. Lie big and lie often. And that's what he did. And when I asked him things like, you're a man of faith, yes. Yeah, of course. And so you pray often, yes? Yes, five times a day. Well, what do you pray for? And he just looked at me in that stare, and I didn't know what to expect. And then he went right into his rhetoric. Well, I pray for the hope and peace for the Sudanese people, and that we'd be a shining light, and blah, 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 yeah. Blah. But there were moments there when his jaw was clenched, that I thought he might go into something else. Or he might say, you know what? You're staying.
Unfortunately, I hope when you screen the film, you also show your interview with the dictator. I know you don't have it.
One of the reasons we don't, Bob, is because it at the end of the film, it conveys the message that there's been a ceasefire. Don't worry about it. The genocidal maniac actually was pretty nice. He allowed you to come back into the country.
If we
would have included it, it lets the viewer off the hook. And the bottom line is, this is very serious, and it's continuing. It's not past tense.
Right. But I just want to say, for people listening to this who go see the film, maybe, you know how when you issue the DVD or something, there are the outtakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to tell you, as somebody who knows your work and knows your courage, I respect it more when you confront a dictator than I do when you're playing a defensive position in football. But nonetheless, you know, I know you. And when I saw that scene where you're going face to face with the dictator and confronting him with his war crimes, people should see that. And I hope you at least include it in the DVD version, because that took incredible guts. It really did. I mean, that's not kidding around. We talk about, you know, journalists. Yeah, you can confront a governor somewhere or a head of a corporation and yell at him and, you know, raise a question. And what are they going to do? Maybe the police will order you out or something. You're in there with a guy who could just look over at a henchman and your head is gone. You're over.
It's the least I could do for the Nuban people and the love that I have for them, and certainly for my good friend, Dr. Tom Katina. It's the least I could do.
There you go. That's Ken Carlson. The film is Heart of Nubia. See it.
And go to theheartofnuba.com. If you want to get involved, if you want to help out, you can donate. You can write your congressman. We have templates there. You can get yourself involved in a peer-to-peer campaign. There are a lot of ways to get involved. Try to find a little bit of Tom Katina in each and every one of us.
Thank you, Ken Carlson. Our producers are Rebecca Mooney and Joshua Shear. Engineers are Kat Yor and Mario Diaz, with a great credit for Sebastian Gubar at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. Heart of Nuba is the film. Ken Carlson's the director.
Thank you.
Check it out.
Bob.